Okay, good morning, everybody. So I'm actually here to complicate the value of n. Oops. I'm here to complicate the value of n by allowing you to use much bigger numbers for that. But mainly, I'm going to talk to you about why you can't really scale up the cloud or talk about scalability without considering IPv6 as a necessary part of that. This is what the IANA free pool looks like currently. That's that red line that dropped down and kind of hit the floor last year in April. It's empty. There is no more IANA IPv4 free pool, though Aaron just handed back almost a /8 worth of scattered blocks to IANA, so there is once again a small uptick in the IANA free pool, but that will get distributed pretty rapidly, I suspect. APNIC is already out of addresses as well. RIPE NCC will probably run out fairly soon. They still have a few addresses left, but I expect in the next few months we will see Europe run out of IPv4 free pool. Aaron currently has enough addresses to coast until sometime around the middle to end of next year, but that is pretty much the last of the big regions to run out, fortunately or unfortunately. These numbers are a little bit out of date. Aaron is now at half of that number. These numbers are from September 4th, 2011. So between September 4th and now, that's what, about 9 months, we've gone through half of the available address space. So by that token, we should have about another 9 months of Aaron free pool left. You'll notice that it is by far the largest of the free pools, and that remains true today. IANA ran out first. They ran out February 3rd, 2011. The other RIRs started running out with APNIC April 15th of 2011. Coincidentally, that was the day that the riots started in Egypt, so I don't know if there was a connection or not. But, end user providers start running out shortly after RIR run out, most likely the larger ones first. That's already happening in the APNIC region. There are already users that have IPv6 only, in some cases in the APNIC region. So this theory that everything is on IPv4 and IPv6 is optional no longer holds true. If you are running an IPv4 only service, you are running a service that will get progressively more and more disconnected from the internet as time goes by. So how ready are we for this IPv6 thing? Well, the good news is there's a lot of stuff that's ready. I won't read you all the bullet points. But the bad news is there's also a lot of things that are not ready. And from what I understand, a lot of the configuration management and cloud provisioning systems are one of the things that are not ready. So that might be one of the topics we want to discuss today. But I want to start by asking you guys some questions. First of all, how many of you have started planning the IPv6 deployment within your organization? Just started considering it, thinking about it? Okay, about half. How many of you have IPv6 at least running in a test lab? Ah, good. That's better than most audiences I talk to. How many of you have started deploying it to servers and or desktops? Wow, okay. Usually most of the hands are gone by that point. And how many of you have a fully production dual stack network everywhere? Couple. That's good. Okay, that's where we all need to be 6 months ago. Hurricane Electric's been there for 5 years at this point. So if you want help, we're available. Cloud computing does depend heavily on the end-to-end model. Pieces of your cloud in separate walled gardens are very inconvenient at best and outright dysfunctional in most cases. End-to-end addressing requires IPv6. There simply aren't enough addresses in IPv4 to do this. More and more of the cloud is becoming mobile. And with the increase in mobile devices, there is just no way to do that without a larger address space. There are only 3.2 billion unicast addresses in IPv4. There are 6.8 billion people on the planet. It doesn't take a rocket scientist at an average of 5 devices per person to realize that 5 times 6.8 plus infrastructure, routers, servers, et cetera, is more than three. More and more of the cloud, IPv6 presents vast new opportunities and capabilities for redefining the cloud. I come from the networking space. We're kind of the original infrastructure as a service product. We've been infrastructure as a service since before there was TCP/IP. So in that regard, we kind of understand some of this stuff. I hear a lot of people say things like, I don't need to do IPv6, I have enough IPv4 addresses for years to come. That's great if you're on the internet to talk to yourself. Most people aren't on the internet to talk to themselves. If you're there to talk to yourself, RFC 1918 works great, move along, thank you so much, bye. Most people are on the internet because they want to talk to other organizations. Well, more and more of those organizations are going to be IPv6 only, or at best, severely degraded IPv4 capability, because there simply aren't enough IPv4 addresses to give everybody coming online an address. The Asia Pacific region has less than one quarter of the total address space and more than half of the population of the world. Most of them are not online yet. All of the workarounds for lack of addresses in IPv4 come with some really bad trade-offs. We've all sort of gotten used to NAT, and there are some people that even have such a perverse worldview that they've grown up thinking NAT is a good thing. But it's not. It's actually quite harmful, and it actually blocks a lot of innovation. So how many of you think your organization will be fully ready for IPv6 this year? Wow, the hands that said they had a full dual stack network didn't go up. That's interesting. How do you plan to cope with a world when there are no more IPv4 addresses available? I'm not asking for answers right now, but these are things you should be thinking about if you don't have a plan for getting to IPv6 pretty well underway. How do you plan to cope with a world where some of your customers have only IPv6 connectivity or severely degraded IPv4 capabilities? You basically have two choices. You can go with the dual stack approach and make your services available on both v4 and v6, or you can say IPv4 is just fine, we just need more NAT. Me, I'm going to the beach. So I'm going to talk about some of the basics of IPv6 and how to get there. I'll talk a little bit about addressing methods, how to configure native dual stack on Linux, how to do IPv6 if you can't get native connectivity from your ISP, because that is still an unfortunately common occurrence, and how to get IPv6 for free, because people seem to like free. I won't read you this table, but this gives you some of the basics about how IPv6 is different from IPv4 and how big the address space is. This is actually a little bit easier to wrap your head around. If you think of an individual IP address as an M&M, a large bag of almond M&Ms is roughly 254 M&Ms, and yes, I did count a couple of bags to make sure that that was accurate. IPv6, a single slash 64, yes?
Are the two extra M&Ms for network and broadcast?
Yeah.
Microphone.
That wasn't worthy of microphone. It didn't need to be recorded. Unknown and broadcast M&Ms are not included in the bag. So the common subnet size of a slash 24 in IPv4 is 254 usable unicast addresses. The common subnet size in IPv6 is a slash 64. That would be enough M&Ms to literally fill all of the Great Lakes. Now, if you want to think of M&Ms as subnets, one M&M per subnet, then the entire IPv4 address space gives you enough M&Ms to put a single layer of M&Ms across 70 yards of an American football field. Whereas there are enough networks in IPv6, there are enough slash 64s to again fill the Great Lakes full of M&Ms. So this literally means you have the Great Lakes full of M&Ms squared of total address space. It's a big number. This requires thinking about addressing differently. Scarcity has become such an endemic state of mind in IPv4 over the last 20 years that probably most of the people in this room don't even remember when IPv4 addresses were not scarce. How many people in this room remember being able to configure a network without NAT? How many people like that idea? Yeah, okay, this is an unusual crowd. Usually I get a lot of, huh? So that's good. That means you guys won't have as much trouble adapting to IPv6 because there is no more NAT, and it's a good thing. In IPv4, we had to constantly balance this trade-off between trying to aggregate networks so that the routing table would scale and dealing with address scarcity and wanting to issue smaller chunks of address to organizations. In IPv6, at least for the first 1/8 of the address space that we're currently allocating, we're gonna try ignoring scarcity and just going with aggregation as the first priority. In IPv4, this meant that we tended to use a sequential slow start methodology that resulted in frequent fragmentation of the address space. In IPv6, we're trying to use sparse allocation and or bisection to issue large blocks of addresses to people with large reservations around them to allow them to expand and create minimal requests for more and maximize aggregation. In IPv4, NAT was necessary for address conservation. In IPv6, it is generally unsupported and not needed. In IPv4, we had two ways to configure addresses. There was static and there was DHCP. In IPv6, we've added stateless autoconf and we've expanded DHCP to be able to not only allocate addresses, but you can now actually use DHCP to assign large prefixes to routers that then assign smaller prefixes to subordinate routers. Any questions before I move on to address scopes? Okay. Link local is the most basic address scope in IPv6, and it literally means that the address cannot cross a router boundary. It is only valid on that particular link. And a host may actually use the same link local address on multiple interfaces, though usually they won't. Most Sun systems will, or are they Oracle systems now, will do that, however. Site local was deprecated a long time ago, so you probably won't ever see a site local address. These were theoretically addresses that were only valid within a site. That was deprecated in favor of something called unique local addresses, which are essentially RFC 1918 ported to IPv6. In my opinion, it serves little to no purpose and will probably eventually get perverted into unicast anyway. ULA replaces global address scope. Sorry. Global scope addresses are addresses which are what we're used to dealing with in IPv4, an address that can be routed anywhere on the internet. Currently, those are being issued from 2000/3. IETF may delegate other blocks to IANA later. That remains to be seen. We are nowhere near using up 2000/3 as yet. Of the 512/12s that can be issued to regional internet registries by IANA in 2000/3, so far I think 7 have been handed out. So there's 505 remaining /12s. Stateless autoconf is the easiest way to assign IP addresses in IPv6. The address configuration method consists of turning the host on and it gets an address. The good news is it provides prefix and router information. The bad news is that unless you have the latest and greatest DNSRR implementation, it does not provide DNS addresses, and it certainly does not provide NTP, next server, or any of those other little configuration details we all know and love from DHCP. If you want that, you have to go to DHCP v6. It also assumes that all routers advertising the same priority are created equal, and that any router can be used as default, as long as it advertises itself. This means that if you allow RAs into your network from every port, you run the risk of somebody deciding to say all your packet are belong to me. Rogue RA can be a serious problem and you need RA guard on your switches to avoid that. So make sure you're pushing your vendors on that as one of your requirements when you start buying IPv6 equipment. This is especially important in wired access points. Stateless AutoConf basically wakes up and the host uses its MAC address to cobble together its own link local address by putting FE80::: in front of the MAC address. However, the MAC address needs to be a 64-bit MAC address. So if you're starting with a 48-bit MAC address, there's an IEEE-defined standard way to convert that to 64 bits. The way you do that is you take the OUI and EUI and spread them out and stick FFFE in the middle. However, because you have done that, you have now created a locally assigned MAC address, no longer a global assigned MAC address, and so you have to invert the 2-bit of the first octet in order to make it now locally assigned instead of globally assigned. So that's why if your MAC address is 00C0 whatever, it'll become 02C0 whatever when it becomes a link local address. The next thing you do is you say, who has this IP address out on the link? And you listen, and you listen, and you listen. And if nobody answers, great, the address is yours. If anybody says, oh, that's me, then the next thing you do is you shut down IPv6 on the interface and you go away. And a lot of people say, well, that's not robust. Well, actually it is, and it's a lot more robust than what happens in IPv4, which is today you both take the address and then you have competing ARP entries and things get weird in the switch and things get weird in the router and neither host actually works anymore. Whereas in this case, the Johnny-come-lately to the network doesn't work, and it's obvious, and it's a clean place to do your troubleshooting. And the guy that was already using the address is obvious, and he stays consistent in the switch tables, and you can track him down by the forwarding tables, and you know where to find him, and you can troubleshoot it. And he keeps working during that time. So it's actually quite a bit more robust. Once you've got your link local address established on your interface, the next thing you do is you send out an ICMP6 router solicitation to the All Routers Multicast group. All of the routers on the link will then send back an ICMP6 router advertisement to your link local unicast address in response. That's also sent to these router advertisements are also periodically announced to the All Hosts Multicast group at regular intervals. Router advertisements include a whole lot of information, including prefixes, preference, desired lifetime, and valid lifetime. Each time a host receives an RA packet, it will reset the desired lifetime and valid lifetime counters to the values contained in that RA packet. This means that if you have a router that was being a miscreant and issuing incorrect addresses, you can remove those from hosts very, very quickly by simply sending out RAs with valid lifetimes of 0. The addresses will get deprecated immediately, no matter how much time was remaining before that RA was received by the host. Okay? So you have a lot more control over how addressing is done from centralized locations at routers if you're using stateless AutoConf in v6 than you ever had with DHCP in v4. DHCP, you always had to wait for the client to ask the DHCP server something before you could change anything. RA, you can actually push the data out to the clients. Once the desired lifetime expires, the address is no longer used to create new sessions, but it does remain on the interface and existing flows are still allowed to continue. Once the valid lifetime expires, and this is why there are two timers, the address is deprecated and removed from the interface, and any existing sessions using that address are closed. The way that you get your actual global unicast addresses in this process is you take each prefix contained in the router advertisement and couple your IPv6 EUI64 suffix with that prefix. Stateless AutoConf networks are always /64s. There is no other NAT mask for stateless AutoConf. Does everybody understand how that works at this point? Okay. I'm skipping the cartoons. If you guys want to look at them, let me know. DHCP v6 can assign prefixes other than /64. ideally, this is not to assign weird small subnets, which will cause other problems. But it's ideally intended for DHCP prefix delegation. So for example, a cable MSO can delegate a slash 48 via DHCP to your home gateway, and then your home gateway can hand out pieces of that 48 to your various routers and or subnets that are attached to it. And I hear a lot of people go, well, why would anybody need 65,000 subnets in a home? It's not about needing 65,000 subnets in a home. It's about allowing an automated hierarchy of topology to have the flexibility of a wide enough bit field to create both breadth and depth of an addressing plan without really knowing what the network's going to look like from moment to moment when it has to kind of plan this out in advance. DHCP v6 can be used to assign addresses to hosts and other configuration information. It cannot provide default router information. It does not have to provide an address. You can use a combination of DHCP and stateless autoconf called stateless DHCP, where you get your address and your router information from stateless autoconf, and you get your DNS servers and all that other configuration information from DHCP. Or you can have DHCP also assign the addresses. That's up to you. It's flexible. It can provide a lot of information about DNS, boot file, etc. Currently, it cannot provide any routing information. I've been talking to the project manager at ISC and encouraging them to implement what is known as a routing information extension to DHCP, where you would actually be able to specify a list of static routes to be passed along as part of the DHCP information. So that may actually get implemented in spite of the IETF's resistance. We'll see what happens. Vendor support for DHCP v6 is still lacking in some areas. If you're using Mac OS, you can't use DHCP v6 until Lion without doing a whole lot of open source work to make it cobble into the operating system. Static addressing. IPv6 addresses can be assigned statically, just like IPv4. It's very common when building overlay networks, that is v6 networks that coexist with v4, to use one of two techniques. The first is both of them are prefix colon colon address. The first 12 bits of the 64-bit address have to be zero if you're statically assigning them. This should also be true, by the way, of your DHCP assignments. This is done to avoid overlapping stateless autoconf. Address can either be IPv4's last octet or octets expressed as binary coded decimal. So for example, if it was 192.159.10.53, then you might use :10:53. Or you can convert it to hex if you really like doing math in your head, in which case 10.53 would become :A:35. It's up to you. I personally recommend the binary coded decimal. You've got almost enough room to do the entire IPv4 address in binary coded decimal fairly easily. These mappings will not conflict with auto-configured addresses because auto-configured addresses will never start with 000. V6 has this concept called privacy addresses. These are essentially a pathological form of stateless autoconf, which uses a new suffix, not necessarily for each flow. Some operating systems are each flow, some operating systems are per time, some operating systems are after some number of kilobytes. It all depends on the OS, how they implemented when they regurgitate a new address. If you care about this, it's defined in RFC 3041. Basically, you take your MAC address and an MD5 hash with some other bits of random entropy and generate a temporary address, and then the preferred and valid lifetimes still come from stateless autoconf. So essentially, you're just generating your own randomized suffix. This has become an unfortunate default in Lion and Vista, and later versions of Windows beyond Vista. Multiple addresses per interface. We had some support for this in later versions of IPv4. IPv6 has full support for this in all implementations. In IPv4, this was kind of the exceptional case and usually only on servers and routers. In IPv6, single address per interface is actually the exception because in most cases you need at least two addresses to have a useful configuration. You need at least a link local and at least a global unicast. IPsec was kind of this add-on side feature backported from IPv6 to IPv4 and done in a really gnarly way because IPv4 didn't have support for it in the packet header. IPv6 IPsec is a required part of any IPv6 implementation, but you're not required to use it. It's considerably easier to configure IPsec on IPv6, which is not to say that it's particularly easy, just it's not nearly as difficult. And automation may be possible in future IPv6 implementations, and if you look at, for example, Microsoft's Direct Connect product, that's an example of opportunistic IPv6 IPsec. Configuring IPv6 native on Linux depends on your distro. There's etc interfaces or etc sysconfig network scripts ifcfg-interface name. This is an example of an interface file. And this is an example of a Fedora-style ifcfg-eth0 or whatever file. Without a native connection, you've got three different types of tunnels you can use. 6 and 4 has the advantage that it's a lot like GRE, and most people understand that fairly well. It's easy to troubleshoot. It's very deterministic. No magic, but you actually have to configure it yourself. 6 to 4 has the advantage that it configures itself automatically. When it works, it's pretty clean and relatively self-optimizing. It's probably a good choice for some mobile devices if they don't have native IPv6 available. But it's very hard to troubleshoot when it doesn't work, which is about 60% of the time. And the non-deterministic debugging process can really cause you to pull your hair out. Teredo is all of the fun of 6 to 4 with additional UDP magic and Microsoft in the middle. It does have the advantage that it will bypass more firewalls than 6 to 4, whether you want it to or not. It's the only tunneling protocol that really gets through NAT particularly well, and that's because to your firewall, it looks like an outbound UDP session, but in fact, it is a bidirectional, fully global unicast routable IPv6 network tunnel. How fun is that? IPv6 for free. There are a number of free tunnel brokers out there. My personal favorite is tunnelbroker.net, which is operated by Hurricane Electric. We also operate a series of Teredo and 6-to-4 gateways. If you have a presence at any of the exchange points we're at, we'll gladly offer free IPv6 transit across the exchange point if you want to peer with us. In terms of routing, it's pretty much the same as IPv4 routing, just with bigger prefixes. OSPF, you need to use OSPF v3. BGP, it's BGP4, just like in v4, and its address family INET6. Router advertisement, if you're on Linux or any other open source platform, you can use the unfortunately named RADVD daemon to implement router advertisement on your host. And there is support in Quagga and other open source routing programs at this point for v6. In terms of firewalling, IP6 tables, as you can see, looks an awful lot like IP tables, just with bigger addresses. DNS is pretty much the same thing, quad A's for forward, and it's still PTR records for reverse, but the PTR process is just a little bit more complicated to deal with the larger addresses and the hexadecimal notation. Also, we had to create a new reverse zone, which is IP6.ARPA instead of inadder.ARPA. The current bind versions ship with IPv6 template zones, so that's very easy. And IPv6 addresses are valid in bind configurations everywhere that IPv4 addresses are valid, with all the same rules and limitations. Zone configuration is identical, except again, reverse zones are named IP6.ARPA. So for example, here's the named.conf entry for my /48 reverse zone that I run out of my house. In IPv6 reverse zone files, $origin is very much your friend. $generate is very much not. Okay, if you try to $generate a /64, there isn't enough disk space on the planet to hold the swap file that would be needed. Reverse zone PTR records look just like this. Notice how dollar origin saved me a lot of typing in each of the subsequent three lines. In terms of troubleshooting, it's mostly like troubleshooting IPv4. Mostly the same kinds of things go wrong. Just like IPv4, start at layer one and work up the stack until you get it all working. If you're using IPv4 and IPv6 together on the same network and you're more familiar with troubleshooting IPv4, you can actually troubleshoot layers one and two using IPv4 in most cases. And if they work for V4, they probably work for V6. One particularly notable exception to that is neighbor discovery. IPv6 does not have broadcasts. The difference between a broadcast and an all-hosts multicast is left as an exercise for the audience. But this is one of the key differences with IPv6, the lack of broadcasts and the not relying on broadcasts for everything. Instead, we use the solicited node multicast address for neighbor solicitation. In IPv6, looking at the ARP table is ARP 192.0.2.123. The V6 equivalent is IP minus F INET6 neighbor show, and then the IPv6 address. On most operating systems, ping becomes ping 6, traceroute becomes traceroute 6, but telnet, SSH, wget, etc. just work. There's an SSH trick you can use if you've got a dual stack host in the middle and you want to connect a V4 TCP host to a V6 TCP host. You can use an SSH tunnel to do the protocol conversion in the middle. I won't go into the details. The slides should be available on the thumb drive. And then one of the important things that often gets overlooked in V6 deployment is staff training. Hopefully this presentation was a little bit towards that. You're going to need more. Plan for it, budget for it, allocate time for it, and if possible, take away your employees' electronic leashes when they go off to training. It really helps them focus on the class if they're not listening to their pagers go off or playing with text messages, etc. That's all I had in terms of the lecture. You're now free to wake up and participate. And the crowd goes mild.
Hi, I have a small question. Do you have any way of forcing an ISP to comply? We've got the problem that in our country, we've only got the state ISP. They've just got a law getting them to be the only people allowed to use fiber for data communications. And we got the government saying we want IPv6 launch on World Launch Day. And so they gave me an IPv6 interface about 4:30 p.m. on the 5th of June, and it didn't work. They said you have to use neighbor discovery on a /48. They wanted me to proxy all my network back. They didn't know about static routing or anything, and you know, it's sort of, I've got my hands sort of tied. I just set up a reverse proxy with Apache, and I'd like a pointer on where to show them sort of, this is what you've got to do, you've got to static route down, you've got to something, I don't know.
Let's talk offline, because I think that that's beyond the scope of what I can address.
Great.
in front of everybody, but that sounds particularly dysfunctional, and I'd like to work with you on finding a way to get it resolved.
Great, thank you very much.
Hopefully that's not common in many states.
So what does V6 mean for system management and configuration management? Should we be thinking about V6 differently than we think about V4? Is it
absolutely
much? Okay, so how so?
Number one, you don't have to worry about NAT, and you need to consider the implications and ramifications of end-to-end addressing. So you're going to need to think more about host security. You're going to need to think more about host-based access control. You're going to need to think more about how you organize your subnets into security boundaries and things like that.
Well, I guess I'm coming at it more from the perspective of trying to figure out what the underlying data model is that we should be reflecting in configuration management tools. I mean, are we still interacting? I mean, it seems like we're still sort of interacting with the same kinds of constructs.
Yeah, that doesn't really change. The concepts overall don't really change in terms of how to model the data. You just need a wider bit field to store the address. It's 96 more bits, no magic in that case.
Is there So one of the things that I find sort of interesting is that it feels like network management has kind of lagged behind system configuration management in a lot of ways, right? And so,
probably a fair statement.
If you're trying to do sort of end-to-end management of a combination of, you know, compute resources, storage resources, network resources, and sort of build complicated things with them, it's going to hurt. Do you see anything coming down the pike that's going to help with that?
Because in most large enough organizations for that to matter, the difference between system administration and network administration is so siloed across different organizational units, I tend to doubt it. Because I tend to doubt that the network people are going to be willing to have cooperative tools with the sysadmins who they think don't know anything about networking, and I tend to doubt that the sysadmin people are going to want to have cooperative tools with the network people who don't know anything about sysadmin from their perspective, and you know, that this is a traditional tension point across multiple organizations, and I don't see the human factors in that equation improving rapidly enough for there to be a technology solution that solves that.
Yeah, I sort of worry that we're going to have our hands tied before too long, right? I mean, so you see, calling them relatively primitive is probably only slightly unkind. Implementations of infrastructure as a service APIs on top of effectively Linux-based software-defined networking, right? And things are sort of getting better over time, and these... it feels like something's got to give there, and so I'm sort of.
I'm inclined to agree with you, and I think that the world would definitely be a better place if it did improve that way. It's just that you're having to get past a lot of social construct and human factors that I don't see. This isn't a technological problem so much as it's a human factors problem and a human interaction problem. And trying to solve those with technology is one of those things that make me think of Rocky the Flying Squirrel saying, "But Bullwinkle, that trick never works."
Getting people to communicate is so much harder than getting computers to communicate.
Indeed. So, and yet networking is very much about connecting people.
So automating this stuff is going to involve a lot of generation of configs and things, but I noticed, tell me if I caught this right, that there was actually two commonly used formats for IPv6 addresses, the hexadecimal format and then the binary encoded decimal format.
No, the binary encoded decimal format is still hex. It's just if you're converting an IPv4 address suffix to IPv to overlay it as an IPv6 address on the same host,
okay,
then you have two choices of how you represent that. One is you can represent it in pure hex and actually convert the binary value of the IP address in, you know, IPv4 into a hex value in IPv6.
Right.
So 48, for example, becomes 30.
Okay.
Or you can convert it to binary coded decimal, in which case 48 decimal in the IPv4 address becomes 48 hex in the IPv6 address.
Okay. Cool. And then, like, in the reverse pointers, it'd always be hexadecimal representation. Okay.
Well, the reverse pointer, if it's 48, would be 8.4. Whatever.
Okay.
And if it's 30, would be 0.3. Whatever.
Yeah.
But that's just two choices in how you represent the values to yourself. Right. They have nothing to do with the actual technology.
I'm speechless, only because there's so much involved in the, I mean, IPv4 was hard enough. Now there's all sorts of other hard stuff, and I'm just wondering how, from a configuration management perspective, I'm going to learn it and then configure it, and I know I have to.
Well,
I'm not arguing with that.
So the bad news, Dan, is there's more of a learning curve for V6, and you have less time to learn it than you did for V4. The good news is, once you do learn the different options and all of this stuff about V6, it's actually so much easier, because the reason you have so many different options is that we've gone from this, you know, small little five-blade Swiss Army knife of IPv4 tools to the giant Campmatic Swiss Army knife with every blade you can imagine coming out of every possible corner of the knife. And you can actually pick the one that fits the job best. So you're no longer trying to use the big blade as a leather punch. You actually have a leather punch on the backside.
So will then the configuration that I'm pushing or pulling or whatever we're using be simpler or simpler to manage?
Yes.
That's encouraging. Yeah. You made a statement about your slides will be available on the USB stick.
Well, I said they should be.
Yeah. Ah, okay. But and that's where I was going. Since this was put together so quickly, none of the presentations are on the USB stick.
Oh.
However, you didn't mail me a copy, therefore it ain't there.
Oh, I thought I did.
But maybe you did. Anyway, I ignored it.
Okay.
unlike your talk, which I paid attention to. That said, anybody who has a presentation who would like to get it distributed, send a copy to me. I will get it put on the USENIX website, and it will be distributable to everybody else.
I will do that.
Oh, and we have a break soon.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to hold back breakfast. I wanted to find out, how does IPv6 deal with ZeroConf, where with IPv4, ZeroConf had this little hack of setting the TTL so you would never go beyond your local router. Does IPv6 deal with this better for discovering and announcing services and ports?
So I will confess ignorance on what ZeroConf even is.
Okay. It's also known as DNSSD in marketing speak. It's a multicast that lets you announce your services
Apple calls MDNS or
I think so, yeah. There's a bunch of names for it.
Bonjour. Oh, yeah. So in IPv6, it's FF02. It's link local multicast.
Okay. And how is that propagated beyond your router? Can you route it outside?
Well, if you want it to go beyond the router, you have to change to FF0 something other than 2.
Okay, so it's not built in. There's no way to say I want to propagate only one level beyond my router to the next router and so
well,
on.
There are many different multicast scopes defined in IPv6. There's host, there's link, there's organization, there's site, there's global. And so you can choose whichever one of those you want to send your multicast packets to.
That's exactly what I was looking for. With IPv4, we don't have that.
The various boundaries of those things are defined largely by the people administering the routers.
Okay. Where would I find out more about MDNS with IPv6, or is that not a studied problem?
Well, so MDNS, it's not MDNS specific. So just look at generic multicast with IPv6 and understand that MDNS is multicast DNS. So the multicast part of that is what you're looking at. It's the multicast address that controls that.
Okay, thanks.
So what suggestions would you have for a worker bee in an organization that's in denial about IPv6? Tall order.
Well, there are several possibilities. The snarky one that comes to mind is update your resume. Because they're probably not going to last. You need to get them out of denial somehow if you want the organization to be able to continue. I don't know how anybody can still be in denial at this point with all of the publicity and information and whatnot that is out there about this. But people are amazing in their ability to remain in denial. It's not just a river in Egypt. who knew? As a worker bee, if your management is that delusional, I don't have a good answer for you. I'm happy to talk to your management if you would like me to and try and bring a dose of reality into their denial. But that's all you can really do is to try and bring reality in.
I mean, as far as I know, there may be plans, but I'm not privy to them. So. They haven't really shared them with the rest of us, so.
That's unfortunate. Have you asked?
No, I haven't gone.
That might be a good place to start. Hey, by the way, guys, do we have a plan for this? And if so, what is it? Because we kind of need to be deploying.
To become the person who leads the charge.
yeah.
Yeah, well, there is that. You touch it, you own it, after all.
Yeah, I've been a victim of that policy before. So, all right, cool, thanks.
And there is help available, so if you want information about that, contact me after.
And by the way, it's cool to meet someone with the same last name.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not a common last name to see.
Yeah, let's talk afterwards.
Okay.
For me, more than just a question, it's some remarks, because we have implemented sure. IPv6 in our organization. Well, I'm kind of cheating because we are the CCTLD for Chile. So we have to implement IPv6. We have implemented IPv6 mm-hmm. in all the computers for the workers. We have all the servers with IPv6. And we try to push the country to implement IPv6. So. But what it really worked for us, it was this kind of commercial IPv6 days, where, well, the last year it was one day with mm-hmm. IPvC on, where Google was on, where Facebook was on. There was this.
Yeah, last year's test run, and this year ISOC chose to celebrate my birthday with World IPv6 launch, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, and this year it was the launch day. So every year we had to build up a little bit more for those days. So mm-hmm. that really helped for us, that we had to get some work done with our servers, the 4A DNS stuff to work on that day. This year we moved the mail server to have it working with IPv6. So these small things can really help to start up the IPv6 infrastructure completely in the organization. And what else? Well, if you already are working with IPv4 and all the tools, it's not that much difficult to start up with the IPv6 infrastructure completely. I mean, it's not like a whole new world.
Right. I focused a lot on the differences in my talk because those are the things you need to know about IPv6 that you don't already know from IPv4. But understand that if I were to give a comprehensive talk about IPv6, this is like 1% of it. And the other 99% is all stuff you already know from IPv4. So 99% of IPv6 versus IPv4 is 96 more bits, no magic. That's a very key point. In terms of World IPv6 launch, I got to say that it was pretty cool that the traffic graph stayed relatively flat over the course of June 6th. But leading up to it, we saw a 5 to 6x increase over the course of about a month before IPv6 launch day in IPv6 traffic. And then it just stayed up there. And now it's actually continuing to climb again. So I think what happened is everybody scrambled ahead of time to get their stuff onto IPv6 in preparation for IPv6 launch day. And when they discovered that turning it on didn't break anything, they just sort of left it on through IPv6 launch day. And so that was really cool. And now we're seeing more people starting to turn stuff on late. So that's also cool. But I think everybody on launch day just sort of said, okay, wherever it is, if it's not broken, we're just going to leave it alone and coast through the day. Because the traffic literally stayed relatively flat across the day. Which was interesting in that there was no diurnal cycle. It was literally relatively flat across the day. Yes, sir.
Do you know of any
microphone, please?
Do you know of any at all domestic residential ISPs that actually turned on customers?
Yes, AT&T, Comcast, Time Warner, Verizon. Well, all of them on a small percentage of their customers. But when you've got 20 million customers, 1% is a lot of customers. So I don't think it's worth trivializing that effort. All of those guys turned on an awful lot of customers on relatively short notice to pull off that 1% number. Any other questions?